jokes now should come with a set of instructions. Like, if you think it's funny, laugh. If you don't think it's funny, don't laugh. You know, it's...
You've made jokes about things like recent tragedies.
Oh, yeah.
You've made jokes about recent tragedies, and it's caused you some trouble.
Thank God it's been kept out of the papers, though. That's the important thing.
Do you have a rule? The rule, some people say it's like, you know, tragedy plus time. Like, what's your time limit?
No, I like to do it right away.
Gilbert Gottfried on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. We'll speak with him about why there's no such thing as too soon when it comes to his comedy. But first, if you've ever spent an evening at LA's Magic Castle, one of the performers you may have seen there is Richard Turner. He doesn't call himself a magician. He calls himself a card mechanic. But watching Turner work with a pack of cards is pretty magical. What many people don't realize, though, and can't quite believe, is that Richard Turner is blind. A documentary is out now about him. It's called Dealt. I spoke with Richard earlier this year, along with the filmmaker Luke Corum, and I began by asking Richard what the difference is between a magician and a card mechanic.
Good question. First of all, the term card mechanic came around 50 years before the invention of the automobile. It refers to somebody who fixes something. A car mechanic, they fix a car. A body mechanic is a professional hitman. They fix a death. A card mechanic is somebody who fixes a card game, can control the outcome of a card game.
I will have to tell our listeners, because they can't see you right now, that you actually have a deck of cards in your hand and you are shuffling them as we're speaking.
And I'm not just shuffling them. I'm actually practicing moves. Right now, if you watch those cards being shuffled, they're going every other card. Watch, I'll do it in slow motion for you.
Okay. What are you practicing?
Oh, I was practicing shuffling every
That was
every
called
card.
A Pharaoh shuffle, Pharaoh what shuffle. You just did, where and one card weaves in between the other one. It's a perfect shuffle. Wow.
And then I unshuffle them after I shuffle them.
So basically he can shuffle them and then shuffle them again. They go right back into perfect order.
So do you know where every card is?
Every card in this deck is in my hand right now. Can you see it? Hello.
I can see.
Madeline, hello, testing.
Yes. But how do you know which card is which?
Well, let me just put it this way. My fingers can feel and maneuver and do things that other fingers can't do. To give you a for instance, you can take this deck of cards and shuffle it up. You can tell me how many players you want for, let's say, a card game. You can tell me where you want the winning hand to be, and I'll deal it out and I'll make that particular player win. That's just a for instance.
Like a blackjack hand,
or
for
blackjack.
Example.
For example, you want me to do that for you real quick?
Sure.
Shuffle the cards.
Okay.
Now here we are live. You're listening to a visual demonstration.
I know. We will have to make
this
visual.
All right, just hand
her
the cards.
Okay, so I'm shuffling?
Yes.
You are now shuffling.
Well, I can't do it every other one.
You do it whatever,
sure.
In whatever fashion.
Oh, here we go. A professional bridge player.
Wow,
ooh.
That is
ooh.
Really sad.
Okay, set them right here.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you. Now, we're going to pretend that we have a little casino here.
Okay.
You tell me how many players should we have at the table? Say three or four for time's sake.
Okay, let's say three.
And you're my secret partner. Do you want to sit the first, second, or third position?
I'll be at the first position.
First position. So you want player number one. You have $500,000 sitting on that hand. There are three players and the house. What's your first card that you have dealt there?
I have an ace.
And what is that card?
A queen.
You have
blackjack.
Blackjack. You were at Benny Benyon's place. He let you put any amount you want on the first bet. You had $500,000. You walked out with $1.25 million.
And he can do that every time.
Wow. Yeah. Every time.
Every time.
But you just shuffled.
How
you
did
shuffled.
You, do
you cut. You chose how many players. You chose where you wanted to sit.
But here's the thing: I probably didn't choose any of that. You chose it for me in some way.
No,
I didn't.
I tell you, I've been filming this for 3 years solid, and we've put his stuff on slow motion or glass bottom tables, you name it, and I still have no idea how he does it.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you two meet?
So I actually grew up performing magic. My dad made his living as a professional magician back in the 80s, wrote books on the subject, and is known within the sleight of hand community. In fact, he actually performed at the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles. So a friend of mine came to me a few years ago and says, Luke, I heard about this magician. He's more like with a card mechanic, which I didn't know what that was at the time. But he said, and he's also blind. He's like, he's amazing. And I was like, wait, what's his name? He's like, Richard Turner. So I call my dad. My dad says, Luke, I've been trying to tell you for years, you need to make a film about Richard Turner. So he introduced me to Richard. I'm in Austin. Richard's in San Antonio. I drove down. And like I said, I've been around magic my whole life. And the first time I ever saw him shuffle a deck a dozen times and spread them out in their perfect order, I thought, my jaw hit the floor. And I was like, this is spectacular.
It is spectacular, and it would be spectacular if you weren't blind. I mean, that almost seems to be beside the point, and yet...
Well, that is beside the point, and it's to your disadvantage that you have sight. I'm sorry.
Well, no, but you do make the point that you wouldn't be who you are today if you were sighted, right?
Yes, I consider it an asset because it caused me to focus on my fingers and not be distracted by the visuals. Because, you know, you figure 90% of what our brain takes in comes in visually. Mm-hmm. And that means the other four senses are kind of get the leftovers. And so I was able to develop those other senses on a level that was very unlikely to have been developed if I would have based everything I did, like everyone else, on sight.
And you lost your sight when you were very young. How old?
I started losing it when I was 9 years old. But it was a progression. It started off, by the time I was 11, it was what's measured at 20 over 400, which is twice as low as what's considered legally blind. And even at that, I had no macula, which is the center of the retina. That was the first thing that dissolved. So just picture wherever you look, there's a hat in front of your face. So I could only see out of the edge of my eye, and that was the 2400. So it was just a fuzz or a blur. And then as the years progressed, that degeneration that started in the center of the eye slowly went out and encompassed the entire retina.
In this documentary, it really shows how you have come to terms with being blind. At first, you didn't want to be described as blind, and now you seem to have changed.
Well, partly it was losing what vision I had left, you know, and then I had to come to terms with it. And it took me a year before I even accepted the fact that I'm running into things, cracking my head over walls and doors and causing all kinds of injury. And my wife's going, and my son's going, come on, you know, admit it, you need help, accept help from people. And for me, partly it was that I wanted my stuff to stand on its own. Like when I perform at the Magic Castle, even to this day, I don't let them make any comments before, during, or after the show about my vision because it's irrelevant for that point. I didn't want you to think, okay, this guy can't see so well, so I'm going to have to coddle him. And I didn't want to be coddled, if you would.
But you don't see anything. You see total darkness.
No, I do not see total darkness. I do not see anything that's real, nor do I see light. But I have a condition called Charles Bonnet syndrome. It was first documented in 1760. In a nutshell, to tell you what it is, probably the person that's the foremost authority on is Dr. Oliver Sacks. He's a best-selling author, wrote the book The Mind's Eye, Hallucinations, and both of those books dealt with Charles Bonnet syndrome. And up until 1990, there was only a half a dozen documented cases. Then he documented a few dozen more. And I'm probably the most extreme case. And to give you an idea of what I see my subconscious in external space. In other words, I see what you see in the back of your mind, like when you're dreaming or whatever, I see in front of me just as clearly as you see everything that's in front of you. And how that's useful to me is I've designed houses, patio decks, furniture, board games, puzzle games, all using this visualization.
And you use it to practice with your cards.
And I use it to practice moves with the cards. I'll have the deck when I'm at a restaurant. I have my hands under the table. I'm playing with my deck, and I spell that D-E-C-K. Make sure you guys understand this. This is radio. But I will be watching my hands, and I'm doing it as we speak. And I'm seeing my hand deal out the second card, put it in the deck. And I will watch and analyze my technique. But yet if I look up at you, now I cannot see it. I'm still doing the same move, but now I cannot see it. But I have to be actually looking towards my hands. But yet between me and the hands is a solid table. Another one of the coolest things is like when I want to remember a name or a script or a phone number, I can write the number down in the air and I'll see it floating in the air just as clearly as you'd see it on a computer screen. And I have what they call an eidetic memory. I take a picture of it and I never forget it.
Well, we actually, when we interviewed Richard, it was an all-day interview, and Bradley Jackson, who worked on the film with me, he said, all right, Richard, I'm going to give you my phone number. And he gave it to him right at the beginning of the interview. Fast forward 8 hours later, he goes, Richard, what's my phone number? And he immediately recalled it because he wrote it down in the air and he took a picture of it in his mind.
Do you think you would have devoted your life to cards had you not lost your sight?
If I had not lost my sight, I would most likely have been an artist. All through first grade, second grade, I was known as the best artist in the class, and I could do and paint and draw, you know, beyond my years as a little boy. cards started almost at the same time, about 7 years old from watching Maverick. But that was because we were a card-playing family. And I was the oldest in the family. And one thing about the oldest didn't lose. And so when I'd play cards with my sisters, I started developing ways where I was playing extra cards. And I got a reputation. My sister would tell her girlfriends, "My brother's so good, he never loses."
That got him nicknamed the cheat.
Yeah. And growing up, my dad would say, "Hey, yo, cheat."
Were you cheating?
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The entire time?
Yes. The whole time. I was not discreet. I mean, I was clever in my execution for a 7, 8, 9-year-old, but I cheated every single time I had the cards, every single game. And a professional might cheat once or twice during the entire evening.
Do you see yourself now as a cheat, a card cheat?
Oh, I'm an entertainer.
Richard, how much have you cheated people out of with your card skills?
Well, I hate to say that. But there was a time when, like a boxer, you spend all those years training in the martial arts or fighting and you want to try it out for real. And there was a time when I went off the wagon. It was the middle, it was late night from between 1983 to 87. In that time, I did play a lot of cards, and I did win, hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And were you dealing?
Of course.
So you have to be the dealer to
win
that money.
Well, not necessarily. There are many things that can be done when someone else is dealing. There was one particular guy. How do we get off of me talking about being a bad
when I asked
dog.
Him this in the end when we interviewed him, he...
I wouldn't... I
no, saying, he didn't give me this answer. Yeah, he basically told me that he's not going to tell me how much he's won.
Yeah. Well, now we know.
Now we know.
Well, yeah.
But today, but to set the record straight, today he just demonstrates how to cheat at cards. He's not a cheater today. He just has the name The Cheat.
Yeah, and of course, back then, I was performing as a card shark, a cheat. They knew who I was. And sometimes, a lot of the times, it was against other hustlers. See, I didn't mind cheating people that were trying to cheat me. Here's another, for instance. It was the CEO of not a Fortune 500, not a Fortune 50, a Fortune 20. We were at Martha's Vineyard. And he said, "You can play in our game, Richard, but here's the rules. We know how tricky you are with your fingers. So when it's your deal, one of us shuffles and cuts the deck first, and you have to deal those cards from off the table." He said, "I know it's impossible for anyone to cheat under those conditions. And if you can do it, go for it. But I know it can't be done." Mm-hmm. And of course, he didn't know that. Oh, that's one of my favorite methods.
As we've just seen with what you did with me, that's easy for you. Luke, put Richard into context. You grew up in this world. You've made a movie about this world. Where is he in the pantheon of card experts?
Well, he is the greatest card mechanic, not of today, but of all time. Recently he was on Penn & Teller, Fool Us, their television show, and he did a demonstration on there. Basically, a magician comes on and tries to fool them. And normally what happens is the magician does a demonstration and they discuss it to see if they figured it out. They had no discussion. They just said, "You fooled us." And it was the fastest time that had ever happened. Richard is known as the greatest, and he is the greatest that will ever live.
And what is the key to his success?
I think the key is that he practices. Yeah, he practices all the time. But he's a great example of like unlocking your potential.
I always think it's like Thomas Edison. He says 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. Part of it is just that nobody wants to spend an average of 10 to 12 to 14 to 16 hours a day practicing the same thing day after day, week after week, month after month, decade after decade. I have a friend, he says, "Once I'm gone, it's gone," because nobody's that nutty.
Obsessive.
I call myself the poster boy for obsessive compulsive behavior.
That's card mechanic Richard Turner and filmmaker Luke Corum. Their film is called Dealt. And if you want to see the magic happen, video of Richard Turner doing card tricks for me in our studio is posted on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, comedy, two comedians, the one and only Gilbert Gottfried, and first, John Early. He's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Actor John Early says he grew up as a good boy in Nashville, Tennessee. He spent lots of time at church and at Christian camp, which means he knew what he was doing when he played a Southern mom on the Netflix series The Characters.
I ran inside, I tore up the whole house looking for my denim. My daughter ran up to me. She said, "Mommy, Mommy, why are you acting so crazy?" I said, "Sweetie, I'm acting crazy because I can't find my denim." She said, "Mommy, I don't like it when you're looking for your denim." I said, "Sweetie, it's not my job for you to like me right now. It's my job to find my denim. You know what your job is? To help me find my denim. Now get on your knees and look under the couch."
You can also see John Early on the TBS show Search Party, which just wrapped up its second season a couple of weeks ago, and in feature films like Wet Hot American Summer. Let's listen back now to my interview with John Early from earlier this year. Okay, what's happening in that cut? What are you doing?
That is Vicky with a V. She's a lot of things. I've realized more and more that she's my dad, actually.
Really?
People always assume she must be like women in my family. I saw women like her growing up. My parents are both ministers, no longer like full-time ministers, but when I was young, they were like, you know, they had congregations, like Presbyterian congregations, and they would do services all over, like they would do funerals, they'd guest preach, whatever, all over the South. So I did spend a lot of time with people who looked like Vicky, but I've realized more and more that she is actually my dad when he kind of gets on a tear comedically.
And what's the denim thing?
The denim thing started just with a friend when I was truly looking for a denim jacket with a friend, you know, in a living room, you know, in Brooklyn, like 6 years ago or something. And I truly could not find it and I was furious. And so, and then we were like, we were just kind of going back and forth pretending to be Southern and like pretending to be these like, you know, women kind of cracking each other up, like, "Don't cross me when I'm looking for my denim." You know, it rolled off the tongue very nicely. And then I wrote like a stand-up bit where I was her, and I used to perform her in this very kind of like performance arty way where it would be like she'd start her routine and then you'd see like the cracks and you'd see her kind of on stage, and as she's like doing this domestic material, you're seeing the pain of being like a wife and a mother, you know. And then like I realized like it's so much more interesting to see her kill. Like it's so much better to see her like killing it. She's actually a good comedian. That's why I love doing that so much, because she's far more confident than I am. So like she really is this like very cathartic chance to just be like Monique level wild on stage, just like running around the stage, like, you know, killing it.
So what do your parents think of your chosen profession?
They love it. I am so lucky. They're so insanely supportive. They're both kind of on the very liberal branch of Presbyterianism. They met at Divinity School at Vanderbilt, like when Al Gore went there, you know. Uh-huh. They're very theological, very intelligent. And so they were always very cool with me doing crazy stuff like this. Very, very cool with me just...
Well, it's kind of similar, I suppose. You're on stage.
Totally.
And you're preaching, sort
totally.
Of.
Yeah. I mean, oh yeah, she's... Vicky is very, like, tent revival Christian.
And do you consider yourself Christian?
Not at all. I'm an atheist. And they're so cool with that.
They are?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, like, a Ricky Gervais atheist. I'm not, like, a, like, let's, like, kill everyone's joy atheist. But I You know,
you're
I don't know.
You're a happy atheist.
I'm a happy atheist. Atheism gives me a lot of peace, actually.
All right. You have another series, too.
Yes.
A Vimeo series.
Yes, called 555.
555 with Kate Berlant,
yes,
who's a friend of yours.
Yes, my best friend in
your
the world.
Your best friend.
Yes.
And so tell us about this series.
Well, Kate and I have always had this hunger as collaborators to inhabit kind of like archetypal roles. And it really started from us like wanting to do this short that we wrote like a million years ago based on Debbie Deb, who sings "When I Hear Music." Because she, when she recorded that song, she was discovered by this like sleazy producer in Jersey when she was like a teenager, recorded the song, and then she, like a year later, saw the album with like a hot girl on the cover. She was like a chubby teen in Jersey. She
it
didn't make any
her.
Money off Aww. The song, and it wasn't her on all the images.
No.
And then like 20 years later, she like got a good attorney and like sued them, and now like does like great like summer cookout tours with that one song. It's like making money again. We were obsessed with that story and with like the darkness of that song. Like, and so we wrote this short, which is the first short in the series. That's kind of this like archetypal, like Hollywood, like, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but we wanted to just like very moody kind of cutthroat short about that kind of a story. And so finally we partnered with Vimeo and we were like, we just want to make a bunch of shorts that are like really beautiful and like very dark, kind of like fever dream, but also deeply funny. And they let us do make these five shorts. And we realized kind of the common thread was Hollywood. We were deeply embarrassed when we realized like halfway through the process, we're like, oh no, we don't want people to think we're doing some scathing critique of Hollywood. There's no critique left, you know, to make.
Can we play just a little bit then?
Yes, I know
we
please.
Don't give it away.
Oh my God.
Let's just play a little clip from episode one.
Us together up there on stage, 50-50 like it should be, okay? My moves, your voice, imagine.
Well, this is actually kind of perfect timing because my friend at the mall, she's always wanting to put auburn highlights in my hair and I've never let her, but she wanted to do it next week.
Does she want to get stoned? Let's pull over somewhere and smoke. I have weed. It's so fun to smoke in the desert. And plus, we need to celebrate us together as collaborators.
This is amazing.
I feel like that's just you and her normally.
Totally. No, there is so many of these characters are just blown up versions of our actual friendship dynamic. I think a lot of people kind of mistakenly sometimes think what we do is like maybe mean or something, or we're judging the characters we play. But that's us. I mean, that is fully just us.
So you're just making fun of yourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with John Early. He's a comedian and an actor. And you were maybe best known. I don't know best known, but most recently known as one of the stars of Search Party.
Yes. And TBS's Search Party.
Right. Which is kooky and strange. And all the characters are horrible, or at least almost all of them. And yet they're very compelling to watch.
I hope so. Yeah.
Your character in particular is probably...
He's ruthless.
The worst.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He does some pretty like overtly despicable things. He is extremely manipulative with his boyfriend or ex-boyfriend and has a kind of empty charity that's just a vanity project.
He lies about having cancer.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's pretty awful.
He's pretty awful. But I do...
And yet somehow likable.
I know. I think there's something... It's related to the atheism thing. Uh-huh. I think there's some... He is, of the four, he's the least kind of caught up in this idea or this like very empty pursuit of trying to have a meaningful life or try to like make your dent on the earth. So I think he is like the most realistic about those things. And so he's very aware of his actions. He's aware that he's lying, even though these actions are clearly bad. And there's something kind of
noble. But he's
just
trying to get away with it.
Yes, he is still trying to get away with it. But he says this line that I love so much where he's like, you know, when are you guys going to like realize that lying is a tool? You know, it's I'm horribly paraphrasing their writing, but I love that because it is in the age of like Hillary, of like people who like didn't vote for Hillary because she was like wasn't pure. Mm-hmm. It's like it is a kind of an advanced idea. I'm into Elliot. I like him a lot.
So when you were presented with this character, were you able to shape him into something else, or was he pretty much delineated and sketched out for you?
He was very delineated, but he was delineated with my like sensibility in mind. You know, they I've known Charles and Sarah, the creators of the show, for a long time. I did their great movie Fort Tilden. We were kind of all in like a comedy adjacent world in New York together, and so they absolutely were writing to my strengths.
Really? So they wrote the character for you?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest.
Course.
Yes. So they did, which is so nice.
Unless when you think about it, is that how they think of you?
Oh my God, that is terrifying. That is totally terrifying. No, but I did get to shape it a lot in collaboration with them. But I'm really delighted that he's not just kind of a flat gay person at brunch.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, and that is I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears that gay comedic characters are now a lot more three-dimensional than they have been.
Totally.
And it doesn't seem like you're getting the kind of Will and Grace type gay character, which is a caricature.
Yeah, even though I will say I think Sean Hayes is so genius, and like it is based, I think it's based on like performers. It's like up to the performer sometimes to really inject something with a heart. And also like I like Sean Hayes in Will and Grace because I think he is playing with, maybe it is stereotypical behavior, but like a lot of that stereotype does come from like actual lived in gay culture.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, like the other extreme when it's like all that is erased and like a gay character is like, just like, hey, like I'm just like you and me, I'm normal.
Right.
You know, that to me is more offensive than like Sean Hayes singing a Judy Garland song, a Will and Grace. You know, like that, it's far more offensive to me when people like just completely wipe gay culture out of a character.
Well, do you think then the Will character is more offensive? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, honestly, yes.
Yes. Well, who were your mentors, if you will? Who were your comedic heroes, people that you wanted to mold your career after?
They were all women for the most part. Lisa Kudrow, Amy Sedaris, Sandra Bernhardt, Laura Dern, Jennifer Saunders, Don French, mm-hmm. everyone on SNL, Sherry O'Terry, Anna Gasteyer, Molly Shannon. I also like the men I love, and it's taken me a while to realize that I do love some funny men, but I do love like Michael Showalter, David Wayne, Michael Ian Black, the Stella, Wet Hot American Summer like group. That was very important to me. You know, especially like artistic gay men, it's so easy to just like worship and canonize women, and like you forget sometimes that there are some like thoughtful men out there too. But John Waters was so important to me and so influential to me.
All right, we've come to the part of our program okay. where I have to ask you to do your Britney Spears impression.
Okay, I'll do it for you.
You will?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
What do you want? What song?
Toxic.
Toxic. And I will say this, I usually don't do Toxic because it's, I feel like it's too fast. You can't pick up the nuances, but I will do it for Press Play because I'm such a Press Play fan.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you.
Okay, let's try it. Okay, here we go. Okay.
Baby, can't you see? I'm calling. A guy like you should be rewarded. Is it a
That's it. I'll stop there.
Stop Madeline. Right there. That's really good.
Thank you. Thank
you don't even have to memorize the words.
No, she's deep within. There's no effort.
What is
there.
Your fascination with Britney Spears?
It's obviously when I was little, I loved her unironically. I loved all those albums mm-hmm. and I loved her music videos. I loved the dancing, whatever. And then as I grew up and as she grew up, and there just became this like crazy disconnect with what was actually being released to the public through like her record label and through MTV, whatever, and what was actually clearly going on in her personal life. And I think that's when she became totally fascinating to me, once that gap started widening.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
She seems so sad.
There was that moment when she was just
losing her mind.
Losing it.
Yeah. And trying to rebel and get out of it. And then they like buttoned her right back up, which to me is like the most haunting part of her career. I mean, this is my wish for her. I think she's just getting that check. I think she's getting that Las Vegas check. She does not care. She's found the right balance of antidepressants, like mood stabilizers, and she's just making that money and going home.
Yeah.
That's my hope for her.
You know, there's a movie coming out.
I saw the trailer.
You did?
I just saw the trailer.
Are you jealous you weren't cast?
I'm furious. I called my team. I fired my managers, my agents. I said, why wasn't I approached? And now I have no representation. And so I'm kind of doing this interview as a last effort to get the word out about my talent.
So you're saying this is a desperation?
Yes, I'm desperate.
Being on Press Play?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Appreciate
you're
that.
You're welcome.
All right, we're done. John Early, actor and comedian. You can see his work, his latest in his series on Vimeo. It's called 555. It begins January 31st. John, it's been so much fun.
This has been so much fun. I really love your show.
You can watch all of season 2 of Search Party now on the TBS app. Coming up, one of our favorite interviews of the year, Gilbert Gottfried. He's coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You know his voice for sure.
The other day, I was in a restaurant, and I said, I want a cup of coffee. And the waiter said, how do you like your coffee? And I said, I like my coffee the way I like my women.
Okay, we'll stop that there. You probably know Gottfried's comedy, or at least you know it's adult, offensive to many over the line. You get the idea. But Gilbert Gottfried, the person, you probably don't know much about. A documentary called Gilbert aims to change that. I spoke with Gilbert Gottfried a couple of months ago about it, along with his wife, Dara Kravitz Gottfried, and the director of Gilbert, Neil Berkley. I began by asking Gilbert why he wanted to participate in a documentary about himself.
The first thing that you're wrong with is wanted to.
It was imposed upon you?
Yeah. It was...
By you, Neil?
This really is because of Dara. For a couple of years, I told people I would make a Gilbert Gottfried movie, and most people would roll their eyes. And I never called his agent or tried to actually do it. And one day I was walking down 6th Avenue with this woman named Astrid Dorff, and she said, what's your next movie going to be about? And I said, it's going to be about Gilbert Gottfried. And she looked at me like I was a crazy person. And I said, what? And she goes, that's weird you said that to me because his wife is my best friend.
What?
And they live two blocks that way. Yeah, and we had dinner that night, and I met him the next day, and like 9 months later, she called and said, just come out and do it.
But why had you always wanted to do a documentary about Gilbert?
So I grew up in the 80s, and he's always part of the lexicon. You know, he's always in the peripheral. And my first movie has a Pee-wee Herman line, through line. And I got real curious about what it's like to be a comic and put this persona on and have to be like that person. And Gilbert's someone that never broke that character, and no one knew anything about him. So it just became an obsession. Like, what's he like? What's his real life like?
And you have a Pee-wee joke, right?
Oh my God! Yes.
Can
yes,
we say it on the radio or no?
I you know, hey, you're asking me.
How about you say it and then we'll beep it?
Yeah, so I'll say the joke and go, hey, remember that woman who used to have a radio show? I was asked to be a presenter on the Emmys. And it was right after Pee-wee Herman got arrested in the porn theater for playing with his pee-wee.
And okay, so far I still have a radio show.
And so that was all over the news. And I went on and I said, I really sleep better at nights knowing Pee-wee Herman's been arrested. If masturbation's a crime, I should be on death row.
That was
okay,
racy
that's
material
pretty
good. Back then. That was hard hitting stuff.
Radio.
And then I said, right now my right hand is like Superman. I could take a piece of charcoal and crush it into a diamond. And how did they know he was masturbating? Did they dust for prints?
Do you still do that joke?
I never throw away a joke. Okay. I'm still on stage going, hey, how many of you watch Bonanza?
Like 9/10 of our audience has no idea what you just
said. Now you know my career. You just described my entire career. But I saw it like so many times I've gotten in trouble with jokes. It's like the news takes the moralistic approach that, well, we don't want to say this, but we have to, you know.
Right. So is that what happened with the whole Affleck situation?
Oh my God, yeah.
So this was, for our audience who doesn't remember, you were the duck.
Yes.
And you were no longer the duck. Because of some tweets that you did about after the tsunami in Japan that people thought were tasteless.
Yeah. And then it's like, it was basically me doing what I always do. They kept referring to it as his tasteless comments.
Remarks.
Yeah. Tasteless comments and remarks. And because I guess even they knew if they put the word jokes, people might think, oh, wait a minute. He's a comedian making jokes? That's what the outrage is?
Right. That's his job. So, Dara, why did you I mean, obviously, there's a lot of material here. Is that why you thought this would be a great documentary?
No. You know what? It never even occurred to me to do a documentary. And what happened was Neil came into our lives and he kept pursuing and pursuing and pursuing. And I watched his other two movies that he had made, and they were wonderful. Beauty is Embarrassing and Harmontown. And I was impressed with his, you know, filmmaking skills. And he was so passionate about doing this movie. I mean, he sent us a letter on parchment paper, a handwritten letter. Yeah, I mean, like really nice parchment paper. You know, he just was so passionate. I'm like, you know what, Gilbert? Let's just give it a try. And Gilbert could not make a decision for the longest time. He never made a decision. He really never agreed to do it. And I finally said to Neil, I was like, Neil, Gilbert will not make a decision. I keep asking, he will not make a decision. Just show up, come for a week. If he's comfortable, then just stay. And if he's not comfortable, at least you gave it a try for a week. And let's just try it and see what happens. The next day, he was on a plane from LA and he showed up at our house. And
yeah, I always forget there was that test week. But you look at that week, what happened in that week, there's so many things in the movie, like meeting his sister. I met his sister the first day we shot. His sister, who you meet in the movie, is this amazing photographer, this wonderful person. But it was kind of weird. The whole time I was like, do they think this is real? Because I shot it by myself. So it was always just me and a camera with headphones and hanging a lav on Gilbert, just chasing him around the world. We went to 15 cities in Mexico and Toronto. And I was the whole time thinking, I wonder if Dara thinks this is real or not, because it doesn't look real. There's no crew and lights and stuff.
It didn't really feel real. Yeah. What it felt like is, I'm glad you're on the road with Gilbert, because at least I know someone's buying him dinner.
I think the reason I'm fascinated by people like Gilbert and why comics love him and why people love to watch what he does is he's one of those rare people that is going to do what they're going to do no matter what, which is a very fearless and sometimes gets you in trouble, but comics love that. They always talk about the fearlessness of going on stage and doing and saying what you're going to say, whether it gets you fired or whether it makes you successful. And I'm fascinated by that. I think everyone wants to be like that at some way. So when you see it in Gilbert, it is like, you know, it's exciting. You want to be like that person. So that's why I was interested in it.
There's a comic in your movie. His name is Richard Kind, and he says something along those lines. Let's listen to him.
You were defiant to the audience. Nobody was laughing, and you kept going, and it was
I remember those
simply
days.
The funniest thing I'd ever seen, ever, ever. That's why I can't be a comic. That's why I can't do stand-up. I'm funny, I'll do it, but if I'm not pleasing the audience, it's me, and you are not that. You're defiant to the world. It is the greatest gift you could ever have. You just you are true to yourself. So that's why I think, that's why I admire you. It's why we all admired Lenny Bruce. Yeah. You know, it goes way back.
Wow, Lenny Bruce comparison.
Oh my God, yeah.
There's a moment in the movie with Dick Van Dyke where they sing together. It's really pretty amazing. And afterwards, Gilbert decides to work Blue. But it's the only time, I've known you like 2 years. It's only time I've ever seen you hesitate. But if you watch the movie, you can see Gilbert like pause and in his head think, should I say this? And then, of course, he says it.
Yes. It's like I always think twice, but say it anyway.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
This is so much fun. That's Gilbert Gottfried, and also Dara Gottfried is here, and Neil Berkley, and their new movie is called, the new documentary, it's called Gilbert. And Gilbert is available on demand now on iTunes and Amazon. Coming up, my pick for most awkward interview of 2017. Awkward in a good way, maybe not a good way. Anyway, St. Vincent, she's here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 10 years ago, Annie Clark, better known as St. Vincent, captivated the hearts of critics and indie music fans with her debut album, Marry Me. Her ethereal voice, her smart lyrics, and masterful guitar skills drew comparisons to Kate Bush and David Bowie. Annie Clark released her fifth solo album last fall. It's called Mass Seduction, and on it, she takes her sound in a decidedly more 80s direction. All right, you said that this album is about sex and drugs and sadness, which is quite a trio. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, the record is kind of an homage to all things that can swallow you whole, like those powerful black holes. Mm-hmm. Be them sex or drugs or sadness or you know, power.
And things you can swallow whole. That not only swallow you whole.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was good. Oh, my God. I'm going to, I might work that into the press release.
Well, is this, you know, I know that a lot of musicians don't like to say this is something that is personal or about my life per se or autobiographical, but it's kind of hard to avoid it listening to
why not?
Lyrics.
So why do they say that this isn't personal?
Well, I know.
It's music. That's so strange.
You know, when they say, well, these lyrics could be read many ways. It's not necessarily about my life, etc.
Whose life are they living that they can write about? No, I mean, it is. No, obviously, I think the thing you're speaking to is like there is obviously an element of narrative to it because it's art. It's not a blow by blow account, but it's certainly incredibly personal. But the idea is that it could be incredibly personal and then also totally universal in its first personness. Mm-hmm.
OK, well, let's talk about the personal part, if you don't mind. Do you mind?
Hit me, Oprah.
Let's talk about the drugs part. What drugs were you doing and how into them were
God.
You?
No, not really. I'm really not a druggy person. I was just dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression. So I was trying to more or less like find a way to walk through the world and deal partially pharmaceutically and then partially in other ways with like anxiety and depression and being on the road during that time. So that's where I'm coming from. I've never like put anything up my nose or anything. I'm from the suburbs of Dallas. I was just like trying to figure out how to deal with my life.
Uh-huh. So anxiety and depression, was that something that is that something that you've dealt with your whole life, or is this something that's fairly new to you?
Oh, whole life.
So you have this song.
The conversation. This is actually not the conversation that I was hoping to have.
Okay, what kind of conversation do you want to have?
No, I just mean like I'm the one who planted the sort of like unfortunate Easter egg of like sex and drugs and sadness. Which I mean,
well, you do have a song on the album called Pills.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You are talking about it publicly.
Oh,
and we as a culture are talking about it publicly. We're in the middle of a crisis of pharmaceutical drugs.
Oh, deeply so.
Okay. Let's move on to the sex part.
Oh, great. God, you're really, really, you're really going for it, Los Angeles.
Okay.
Ooh, drive time.
Well, why not? Let's get right to it.
Get you hot before work.
So the New York song, New York, on your album is a pretty sad song about breaking up. And is that a personal song about a personal breakup for you?
I mean, it's a composite for me. You know, it's about walking the streets of the East Village and thinking about the people who you've loved, who've walked those streets before you and gone on either to other cities or to other planes of existence, I guess.
New York isn't New York without you, love. Too few of our old crew left on Astor. So if I trade out for some Hollywood.
So it's full of a word that we can't say on the radio.
or we'll lose our license.
Oh, is that the one?
That's the one. That's the one. Mother trucker. Uh-huh. So
sometimes I like to call my brothers-in-law that word, the MF word.
You do?
Yeah, because they're literally effers of mothers. And I just like them to sit with that and think about it.
Well, I guess all the dads in the world are. So.
Things are really not going well. This is not a good day for interviews. Let's just keep going.
Okay, all right. Let's move on. I like this interview, actually. Okay, let's move on to Los Angeles. And you have a video out for that one. And it seems like you're really taking on the cliche of Los Angeles as being a obsessed with cosmetic improvement.
In Los Angeles, the winter never comes. In Los Angeles, the mothers milk their young, but I can keep running, no, I can keep running.
You just moved here. Is that how you see LA?
Oh, you, that is a, do they call that sandbagging?
Yes, yes.
You are sandbagging me. This is like the hardest hitting journalism I have ever had. And we're just like trying to talk about a fun show. You're really going for it. You're really, you know.
How can anybody have you? How can anybody have you and lose you? How can anybody have you and lose you? Not lose their minds too. How can anybody have you? How can anybody have you and lose you? How can anybody have you and lose you? Not lose their minds too.
Oh. It's not the most flattering assessment of LA, but it's not my sole opinion of LA by any means. I really like being there. I find it to be a really wonderful place to work. But there is a certain amount of conspicuous consumption or status. It's an industry town if you choose to operate in that world all the time, and that's it has a value system in large part that is different from my value system, or certainly something that I try to kind of like keep at bay. And again, I'm not talking about the whole of Los Angeles by any means. It's a megalopolis, you know.
Yeah. But it's hard in a showbiz world to keep that at bay because a lot of it is about image, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to be the person who got the plastic surgery memo, but like got it slightly wrong. Like I get a nose next to my other nose.
Kind of a da-da approach.
Yeah, like I think that like, well, butts are out, but calves are really in, you know? Anyway.
Okay, let's talk about the sound in this new album and how it differs from the previous ones. As I said in the intro, it has more of an 80s feel to it. Did you want it to harken back to the 80s in some way for a particular reason, or do you just like the sound of that?
I mean, I feel like the number of times I was like trying to reference like throbbing gristled drum sounds and like Nine Inch Nails. Like I probably said Nine Inch Nails like 80 million times in the studio. Just, I don't know. So, I mean, there's certainly like a lot of talk of that kind of late 80s industrial music, which I'm a big fan of. And I worked with Jackie Antonoff. He co-produced the record. And
he's worked with Lord and Taylor Swift. And
yeah. So, and that's, the 80s are certainly, I guess, a soft spot for him as well. So.
Was that the music that was most influential to you as you were coming up?
No.
What was the most influential to you?
Oh, I think it's probably impossible to say what was the most influential. I mean, I don't know. It's sort of like relationships, too. You can have like one that lasts a day that like impacts you forever and some that lasts for years. That you're like, yeah, I went back to that. And like, that didn't really do it for me anymore.
What are you listening to now that you really like?
What am I listening to now?
Mm-hmm.
Terry Gross. Ira Glass, Invisibilia, Love and Radio.
That's called not sandbagging, but telling the interviewer what she wants to hear.
What? No, I'm saying that like I listened to so much NPR. That was that was like a high five.
Oh, okay.
Wait, did you think I was being a
Well, a little bit. Yeah.
No, I wasn't sandbagging. I was saying, I was just making a joke at how uncool I am. That's okay, that was the joke. Not, the joke was not on you.
But do you feel like sometimes you're misread? I've been reading some interviews where the interviewer feels like they don't really know if you're messing with them or not.
That I get misunderstood by? Mm-hmm. I mean, I did like construct a pink box in England and had like a girl in stripper shoes like direct them in, and there's this, I made a soundtrack for it that was like really disorienting. I mean, so yeah, like I don't know that I would say that I was misunderstood, because I'm not even sure what the point of making that was, except to spice things up for me and make it a little bit like fun and, you know, make it an experience for people.
So you're going to be on stage here in LA tomorrow.
Yeah, what is... I am. I'm so excited about it. It is the world premiere of the Fear of the Future tour.
This is part of the Red Bull Music Academy Festival.
Yes, it is.
What can we expect?
You can expect, first of all, a very unorthodox place to have a show. And then you can expect the staging of that show, even just like the walking around of that show, to be bizarre. And then you can expect a show that blooms like a flower. The hope is that it's beautiful and strange and something that people will walk away from going like, I'm really glad that I had that experience, as opposed to not having had that experience.
Well, Annie Clark, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was nice to talk to you. I hope that you can air some of it.
Don't you worry about that. St. Vincent, she'll be back in LA on January 25th at the Hollywood Palladium. All right, that's all we have for you today. I hope you have a really, really great holiday, hopefully some time off work. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you soon.